What am I doing? For a while, I've been on this reconciliation trip. Like, my father started dying a couple years ago, and I came here and spent a year or two with him, and sometimes I thought it was not the smartest decision, because almost as soon as I got to Seattle, I had a nervous breakdown.
Oh, God. This place will do it to you.
But you find that kind of psychic pressure here, too?
Oh, yeah. Totally.
It's nice to hear. But the actual year and a half I spent with him was beautiful, and I got to see that all little girls worship their fathers, and I got to see in that year and a half that he really was a wonderful person.
That's nice. Super reconciliation.
Yeah, and that he really did love me very much, because I got to know him while I was here, and he looked after me, and he used to make bacon and eggs 3 times a day. And that he did love me tremendously. So it was kind of an awkward year and a half, kind of wonderful. And then I came back because he had lung cancer, but it metastasized to his head. And he died from that cancer. But I was here to hold his hand. And somebody else I love very much died. The boy lived next door to him as a cellist. I don't know if you knew him. Jeff Shank,
that sounds very familiar.
Yeah, he was a very talented cellist. I don't know what else he did. I think that was it. And he was killed in a traffic accident in Spain.
Yes, me. Sorry, I'm waiting for you now.
All time.
And that was much worse because it came out of the blue.
Mm-hmm.
There was no... I spent a year and a half with Daddy making dinner, holding his hand. It was a prolonged goodbye. Without the goodbye, it was a terrible, terrible shock. My favorite passage from the Bible, which I've been reading a little bit in, is the trivia's book, is love is stronger than death.
Yes, I believe that.
That's been my experience. So when Jeff died, especially because we grew up together and we were the same age and we were always encouraging each other, you can do it, you can leave Seattle, you can be a professional cellist. I believe in you, so I think in some place in me I assumed that we would go through our lives together. When we were little, he used to tell me, Nicole, I don't want to grow old. Like, I can't bear to be old, kind of thing. You know, so he did die young as he wished. And I assume still beautiful. That was important to him. You know, I felt robbed, but you have to let people, you know, live as they wish. I don't plan to die young. I love life. I'm going to suck it up to the last minute.
When did that happen to him?
Let's see, the year I graduated from college, 1994.
Trying to remember him. The name is so familiar, but I can't quite place the face.
Well, he was very tall, very blonde, very graceful.
Oh, okay. That's kind of hazy now. You went to Eckstein?
Yeah, I was always in some sort of orchestra, junior orchestra, or the way he played the cello was very emotional, very, how can I put that, very masculine, very vibrant, very emotional. He himself was very chic, he was quite tall, he always beautifully dressed, and I'm sure there was always a cast of girls in love with him. We were so close, you know. It's like the brother you choose. And at the same time, I'm heartbroken. I realize I'm very lucky to have had a friend like that. Someone to whom you tell everything and vice versa. Towards the end, in the summers, he started playing in the orchestra in Mexico City. One summer I went there and I spent the summer with him, and that was an extraordinary experience in every way.
Who was the guy that lived down beneath you? He was my friend at X-Men. It was David someone or other.
You lived in our basement?
No, he lived a few streets below you. And he was in our class. He used to hang around out the front, and he was kind of one of the no-goods at X-Dine. But he knew you.
David,
I think his name was David, yeah. I haven't seen him in so long. He lived like three blocks beneath you.
Oh, towards the little plate.
Yeah, exactly.
That was kind of a weird neighborhood.
Yeah, it was. It was a little band of difference there.
David something? There was a guy I became friends with who lived around there. His name was Mike with dark hair.
Oh, Mike, but did he have a brother named David?
Perhaps.
Mike, what was his, Cressley? No. What was his last name?
I don't know, he was a very ordinary looking guy with dark hair. I guess he was an ordinary good looking guy. He lived a street or two below me. I met him at the playfield, became friends.
He was our year and went to X-Time?
I think he was a tiny bit younger than me.
I think he had an older brother, perhaps, and that's who I'm talking about. So where have you been living these last few years?
I came back to Seattle.
Yeah, before Seattle.
Well, my adventures, let's see. I went to Portland and I was a stage actress. And eventually I became a film actress there. Fell in love with filmmaking really hard, harder than you could ever fall in love with a person. And then I went to L.A. and experimented with trying to become a professional actress. And eventually I ended up at UCLA Film School, which was an incredible adventure. And after film school, I worked both on some films and in the studios a little bit. I had a great time in LA, and I do love filmmaking so much. And, you know, I should put aside a couple films to show people. I guess I could find that laptop, I could find some stuff to show you. Filmmaking is just like the greatest adventure because it's sort of like the Jiffy Bake oven of art. You know, you make it right then, right there, and you can show it right then, right there.
It's true.
You're in total control of it. I only love it more all the time.
So were you teaching it or in film school or both? Or?
Well, myself, I went to film school. And a little later, I ended up teaching at a school in Chicago called Columbia College, which is kind of special in that it's open enrollment, and for the most part, it's very hard to get into film school. Very hard. I had a great time in film school. I mean, it's just so exciting to find out what you can do, you know. And, myself, I'm an educator, and later I thought the main value of my education was not so much learning how to make a film, which was wonderful, it was really hard, you know, it was hard to learn, it was a hard pace, everything was really hard. I'd been in film school about 4 or 5 months, and I just started feeling like I can't go any farther, I can't do any more, so... I talked to a couple of friends and like, well, of course you feel like that. Everybody feels like that. You just have to keep going. You have to think about how much time and money you've put in so far. You have to keep going. Which is what I did. I just kept going.
So what aspect of it did you teach?
Aesthetics.
Huh.
Screenwriting, some production, development, acting. That was one of my favorite things to teach, but I don't think people understood very well what I was trying to teach them. Maybe because the acting is so obvious.
To you anyway, probably.
But to people in general, because someone's standing up, someone's talking. You know, there's a human being there. Fucking tragic story. Maybe I should make that story.
for your laptop here for a moment. See if it's around.
It's probably over on that table if it's around.
Maybe in the drawers? I don't see it.
I think people more likely to be on a tabletop than a drawer. Some staff member here just gave me their laptop when I told him I didn't have one.
And what?
I needed one. And just gave me his. Lord.
See, radio. Maybe he had borrowed back for a moment.
Have you ever been in a joint like this?
Yeah.
Really?
You mean being myself in one? I've been in them lots of times, visiting people.
This is a nursing home.
Yeah.
I mean, have you ever been a patient in one of these?
Mm-mm. Well, I've been in the hospital, but not in one of these.
Well, in essence, it is a hospital, and I'm very headstrong, and people always tell me to sit down, don't move. Because the first week or two I was here, I made a couple breaks for it, which is apparently verboten.
Oh, man.
So I have a reputation as an escape artist, and also as getting all cattywampus in the bed. And it's been an experience, kind of a horrible experience for me, you know, because I'm really... I knew this before, but once I came here, I totally realized that I'm very addicted to freedom. Very, very, very. What's this fortune teller? Told me you have no idea how independent you are.
Really? And you didn't believe that? Because you always struck me as being very independent.
Well, don't tell me you have no idea. I didn't completely agree with that. I know it was very independent, but this experience reminds me that I don't have any idea, and that ain't nothing more precious in this world than being able to put one little foot in front of the other on your own. When I can do that again, I will be like, praise Jesus. I'm very independent. There's all these pictures of me as a child running away from home. I guess that was one of my favorite games, running away. I haven't been able to play very well here. My God, these people keep a pretty damn good eye on you. Like, Nicole, are you getting cattywampus in that bed again? They remind you you're not supposed to move around too much. And I fell out of the wheelchair one or two times, so I understand that it's not just silly, you know. They're liable for me, and I did fall even right out of the wheelchair, let alone, you know, trying to get from room to room.
Mm-hmm.
So you've been in a nursing home before?
Well, my grandma was in one for a long, long time.
And you used to hang out there with her?
A little bit, yeah.
So tell me about her catacomb.
Catacomb, that's one way to put it. She was in a coma for many years. So she was sort of there, but not there. And you felt like she was there, like when you were talking to her and holding her hand.
You felt her spirit?
Yeah, you could feel her spirit present. But you couldn't really respond.
So was it still satisfying to visit her? Did you still feel like you were visiting your grandma?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she had a lot of life force. She'd been there for quite a while, but everybody was amazed at how strong she was. She just didn't seem to fade away. I just got the feeling she was waiting for to tell us something. To
that would be a great reverse rock song. Not fading away. About, you know, like this grandma figure who's chain smoking and watching porno and not fading away.
So how many movies were you in?
I don't know. Maybe 12 or 13, I enjoyed each one. A lot of them were student films. One of them was a semi-professional production. That's the one I learned the most from. Do you have Netflix?
I don't, but I do know some people who do.
You could watch my favorite role on it. You could just search my name. Nicole Harrison was my stage name. Mm-hmm. And what was the name of this movie? I can't remember the name, but I remember the role. It was my favorite role because mostly I got cast as a cute, young, sweet, young thing, which is really boring. And in this one, it's a movie called Eddie Presley, about a guy who is a professional Eddie Presley imitator.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay, except that it's his dream to really make a living doing that. And he actually owns a restaurant, and as he embarks on this, he begins to lose everything and begins to not be able to support his family, but he can't give it up. Eddie Presley. And I play the girl that drives him out of his mind. In the end, he's at some nondescript diner, and he asks for a refill of coffee. And she says, only the first refill is free. He's from Texas, he's very polite. He's like, why is that? And she won't tell him, and he begins to lose his mind, and the police have to be called. That's my favorite role. I get sick of being the sweet young thing, you know. There's an excellent bit players in that. I hope I was one of those excellent bit players.
Do you have any other roles in mind?
I love some of the stage work I did. My favorite role ever was there's a very famous feminist play called Uncommon Women and Others. And it's based on Mount Holyoke, where that's one of their little mottos, we bring up uncommon women, you know, and I was on Uncommon Women, and I played this girl who was a documentary filmmaker. She was obsessed with Ludwig Wittgenstein, and she was also bulimic. That was one of my favorite roles. It was really fun to play someone with intellectual life, but more than one dimension.
So you lived in L.A. for how long?
A long time. I'd say I moved there in 1983. I loved it from the moment I got off the plane. I loved the warm air. I loved the people with their boobs sticking out. And, you know, I liked this outrageousness. I always found Seattle really boring. And, I moved there in 1983, and I went into UCLA in 1994. And then I did have some business jobs. I didn't really enjoy them so much. They were very edifying.
Right, that sounds familiar. So many other better things to do.
Yeah, but, you know, the world does run on business, so I think it's good to have had some business jobs. I worked for a couple French corporations, which was fun because I got to speak French on the job. I'm in love with the French language. I learned it so I could have a secret language to speak to my father, who loved the French language. And now when I speak, I read French. I still feel very close to him. And my brother. My older brother, he's French. When he came here, he couldn't speak English, and when he left here, he couldn't speak French. If I speak French to him, he always makes a big joke out of me. He's like, merci beaucoup.
I vaguely remember him.
Remember my brother?
Yep. I met him at your house once.
He has very dark hair.
Yeah, and I think I met him in 7th grade.
Yeah.
He was over, one of the few times I went to your house, he was over there.
I love my brother very much. I mean, first of all, when he was little, I was little, he was my only playmate. You know, people don't really want to play with their parents. And he was always very gentle with me. He was a very gentle person, like my father. And now I love him because He reminds me of my father. He's got this very gentle persona. And, you know, he speaks French, too. His wife is really good, too. He's got this strange relationship with his wife, who's a nurse. He complains about her constantly and how bossy she is. And, yet at the same time, I think that he would be totally lost without her because his first mother, who was French, flat out deserted him. And then my mother sent him to military school. So in his early life, he was abandoned twice by two very beautiful women. So I think having this wife, who's a good wife and totally sticks by his side and is a little bossy, totally arranges their life, like she keeps the house and everything. I think he would be lost with that. I think it's very lucky that, you know, he met her. That would be too terrible to be abandoned by two mothers and then have a shaky wife.
Or someone that abandons you again.
Yeah. When I met them, I asked how they met, and she told me that she was out with her girlfriends and they ran into some guy friends, and they decided to go to her house for appetizers. So they all went to her house, and she whipped up some stuff, and Joel was there. And at a certain point, people began to drift off, but Joel came back. He knocked on the door and he hollered out, "I think I love you." And I really admire that because I'm not that kind of person. I'm too fucking proud.
It's pretty gutsy.
You know, like, he had the nerve to do that, and he ended up married to her. And they have a child, and they're relatively happy, I think. And I'm too proud to do shit like that. I think I love you. But, and it worked out for them. You know, I'm very proud, and that's one of my character failings, my pride. And the Bible does say pride goeth before a fall, which I think is a fascinating expression.
Where's he living now?
He lives, he works on the west side, and he lives somewhere over there, you know. He works at a Thriftway, and he works at a grocery store on the west side.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very nice house. I haven't been to it. I've heard it's very nice. My little sister lives in Columbia City. She and her husband are doing quite well. He makes a ton of money as a marine carpenter. And I just love him to pieces because my sister didn't turn out to be the most practical person. Like, she's not... She works part-time at a YWCA. She's never had a real job, you know, and he makes so much money, he takes care of all of them.
Mm.
And supports her shopping sprees, of which I am the occasional beneficiary. Because she gets tired of things that she gives to me. This is not one, the hospital gown is not one of the things she gave to me. That would be a really good diss, giving somebody a hospital gown as a gift.
Right.
I really, you know, I love him for taking such good care of them, and they have, like, five or six girls, I think. And
oh, my God. Don't keep him busy.
Sometimes if you come over in the afternoon, you find him asleep on the couch with several of the girls, like, grouped around him like little baby cubs falling asleep, too.
Hmm.
He's a really good father. And, I mean, my sister would starve to death if he wasn't taking care of her. And he likes to call me for some reason, because I spend so much time away from Seattle, I guess, Sister Outlaw. I love him for taking care of my sister, so I don't have to do it. Because it would probably fall to me if he wasn't doing it. Did you get married? Did you think about getting married, Brock?
I got married, and I was married for like 3.5 years. Maybe four, I don't know. Maybe 4.5.
Was that a scary decision, or did it just naturally work itself out?
A bit of both. I think it's always a bit scary to go into it, but it was pretty spontaneous and unsolicited, and mm-hmm. just kind of popped out of my mouth one day. Mm-hmm.
The answer was yes. Did that scare you? And the answer was yes.
Well, yeah, of course. I guess you say when you're grown up and very independent, the idea that you suddenly aren't independent anymore and you're dependent on another person and vice versa can be a little disorienting. But it was good. I enjoyed it.
So you felt the spontaneous urge to ask this question. You didn't imagine she would spontaneously say yes. That sounds really interesting.
Well, I didn't even think about whether she'd say yes or not, to tell you the truth.
You just felt this question rising up in you?
It was just she was going to Africa to go volunteer at a hospital, and I wanted to go too, but I wanted it to be partly my thing too, not just hers. Like, I wasn't just following her. Yeah, I didn't want to be a tag along, so I just thought, well, how can I be a part of this? And I just said, hey, we had the same birthday, and I said, hey, we should get married on our birthday in Africa. So
it was cool.
More of an adventure.
Did it all turn out to be an adventure?
Oh, yeah. And right after I said it, I was sort of horrified that I said it. And I said, oh, just kidding. You know, because it was so spontaneous, I was shocked that I'd even come up with it.
Are you not a very spontaneous person, usually?
No, I'm quite spontaneous. But I never really thought that I'd get married. I mean,
in this life?
Well, no, earlier on in the life, I thought I would. But then I kind of let go of that idea. So for me to have just brought it up like that, I think was a little surprising.
For you?
Yeah. And she wasn't someone that necessarily wanted to get married either. So.
I've been engaged a lot of times. As a child from a divorced home, it's really hard to believe it will work out. Very, very hard. I've been engaged several times. I've lived with a lot of people. I'm not engaged now, but I sort of think I will marry my current boyfriend because he's so, for all kinds of ridiculous cliche reasons. Like, you meet somebody and you understand all these ridiculous cliches because he's so, one thing, I find him very beautiful. And what else? Because he's so devoted. And I want to see how his story turns out. I want to see how my story turns out and how our story turns out. And he's my best friend. I understand all these ridiculous cliches now. I just want to see how it all turns out.
No, that sounds good. Right. She was kind of my best friend too, and we hung out together and lived together. And we're still close friends, like brother,
wonderful.
Sister.
That's real. That really can happen.
Mm-hmm.
That you can still be close friends. Like, you still call her up and talk to her if you've had a hard day or something.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I go over and hang out with her. And even though she's been living with a guy for like 4 or 5 years, we all hang out.
That's beautiful.
She's like my sister.
Well, Justin and I just got our first home together. And then I got so sick, and he's been hanging out at the nursing home with me. Like, what higher proof of love do you want than that? You know, and he gets really alarmed when I try to do too much. He's like, no, baby, no, you can't even walk.
You get dizzy, or what happens?
I fall down a lot. I'm left, what do they call that? Left side unstable? My left side isn't very strong.
Mm-hmm.
All of this started when they put me on this drug called, what's it called? Depakote. All the shaking that started on the Depakote. I don't know about these tumors. I have tumors rolling around in the back of my head. I don't know where they came from.
Depakote.
That's a drug. It's an anti-seizure drug. And they discovered it can help bipolar people. I was taking it for about 4 months. I didn't like it too much. It made me feel real edgy. Then I started reading about it on the internet. And one of its well-known side effects is making people fall down.
Yes.
You know, and nobody, that's okay. Nobody told me this, though. So somebody said to me, Nicole, do you want to take a drug that makes you fall down? I would have said, no, I really don't. I already feel like I'm falling down. Thanks a lot. I guess it's great that there's all this info on the internet, but it's kind of pathetic. That's how you have to find out.
Yeah, no kidding.
Serious side effects.
Right. Well, they don't sell it if they tell you the side effects right up front, probably.
Well, if they...
I mean, as you say, a lot of it's about business.
Well, I went off of it on my own because I didn't like the wobbly thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, they didn't like that I went off of it on my own. Not just to make your own decisions like that. And, they wanted me to go back on it, which I want to do, but they were shaking their finger at me, and I am an alcoholic. And a big problem alcoholics have in general is they cannot follow directions. Not any directions. They cannot even follow directions of work. As simple as, we want you to shred that stuff in the corner over there, then let us know it's been shredded. They can't even do that. They're very headstrong. So, So I was a little suspect of my own reluctance to take the medicine. Does that make sense?
Totally.
So, I know I'm totally headstrong and stubborn and... Oh my God. So... And that's very awkward. Like, some people might see normal suspicion of a new medicine. For an alcoholic, you have to keep in mind, like... What do they call that character defect? When you just can't listen to anyone. Stubborn, I guess.
It can be a good thing, too.
Depending on the circumstance. I suppose if you are a junior Nazi and you've been ordered to gun down a bunch of children and you're reluctant to do it, it could be a good thing. So, yeah, the Depakote. So I went off of it on my own, which they didn't like one little bit, but fuck them. You know, is my body my life, and you're not the one that's wobbling all over the place. And when I went back on it, it was kind of disastrous. I woke up, I took a dose, I fell down on my knees, and I could not get up again.
Wow.
That was really scary. And that's what it took for me to see, like, this is the wrong drug for me. And, you know, I don't know what it takes to listen to yourself. I already knew that this was the wrong drug for me, but... I had to get on my knees and not be able to give up to be sure, you know. And after that, I told them I wasn't going to take it anymore, that that was too strenuous a side effect for me to accept. The happy part of the story is that refusing to take any more of it led them to find drugs that didn't knock me so sideways, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Depakote era. Now I take an antidepressant in the morning that is not so... No, that is kind of balancing and mild. It's not so severe. And in the evenings, they give me something called relaxants. I love these things. They, basically, they enable you to sleep. I was like, what is a relaxant? I guess it's something that enables you to sleep.
A muscle relaxant or an actual, like, lets the mind unclamp itself a bit, too?
It's called a relaxant. I don't know. Yeah, it seems to relax your body and your head a little bit. And just knowing there's something you can do relaxes you. Knowing that I don't have to stay up till 4 in the morning today.
Mm-hmm.
I've gone from being very suspicious of these people who developed these drugs to appreciating them. Well, my ex-fiancé was one of these people. That's part of why I'm suspicious of them.
Because you were suspicious of him, or you knew who he worked for and what, you know, what they did to produce them.
Because he totally lost his sense of vision in the whole process. He was a good scientist, I think. And at first he was doing pure research. And eventually started working for some drug development company. When I first met him, he was fascinated by, like, by stuff like trephining. I guess nothing really changed. He's really brilliant guy. I hope at least he comes up with something useful. So I've gone from being totally suspicious of these drug companies to being grateful that somebody invents this stuff so I can get a decent night's sleep. And then you get a little more sophisticated about the different drugs and their different effects. Like here, they've been giving me something called Avnacet, because I ran out of medicine. And Avnacet is much has the same effect, but it's much milder. When you take these relaxants they give you at Harborview, you feel like a caboose come up and smacked you.
Wow.
You know, well, there's no arguing that you're relaxed after that. But, but you know, I probably need to get smacked by a caboose. This Avnacet is much, much gentler. It's more like taking 3 or 4 strong Tylenol, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how I feel about knowing so much about the medicine. I have mixed feelings about it. Supposedly I have a bunch of tumors banging around the back of my head.
From what? Do they know?
They don't care to figure it out. You know, only freaks need to know these things. They don't know why you need or want to know. You're supposed to accept that there's a bunch of tumors and they took pictures of them. And my God, I've been here like 18 hours and I went upstairs to breakfast and some woman came up and introduced herself to me. I don't know if you had the experience, people are constantly introducing themselves in their roles to you here. She was very nicely dressed, like from the Bon Marché. She had on like a nice black skirt and a nice white silk blouse. And I'm sitting there sucking down some bad coffee and some tepid pancakes.
A little gooey in the center.
Yeah, and she tells me that I'm going to die. And it was funny. I had this urge to reach out and throttle her.
Doesn't leave much to work with, does it?
What, you're going to die?
Yeah, I mean, come on. It's, what kind of message is that?
And probably saying, lady, look at me. Look at you. If one of us is going to die, I think it's going to be you in your little Bon Marché skirt. Look at me in my Emmanuel Ungaro outfit. I'm not dying.
So what do you suspect?
I don't know. Well, I told her. I'd never been happier. I refused to die. Some other time I might oblige you. I've never been happier and I absolutely refused to die. So, she still looked like a desk jockey lady. And apparently she was upset because nobody had told me this. So I could totally, because I had a lot of stuff at my old job that used to just sit on my desk. A lot of it was stuff other people should have done. I could totally relate to her. Like, no one's told this poor girl she's gonna die. Somebody should do it. That's a pretty large, you know, unfinished end. Well, I appreciated she was trying to be responsible, but I still felt like throttling her. So she bounced off in her merry way in her Bon Marché outfit. And after a while, the strangest thing happened. I guess I was lying on the floor with like a pillow like this. I'm totally estranged from my mother. I don't know if you remember that.
I do remember there being a lot of distance.
It got worse as the time went on. And I got more determined about it. And I became convinced she was a threat to my mental health, and in that sense, it was perfectly okay to stay away from her. And I'm lying here like this, and you know how you would sense when someone's staring at you or whatever? I sense someone was bending over me. So I opened my eyes and my mother was like bending over me like a snake. And that just kind of scared me a little bit. Except that she had such a look of worried concern on her face. For one moment I could stop seeing her as the enemy and just see her as a woman who was very worried because her child had tumors. I could have compassion for that. Mm-hmm. That was very strange. Still, it was scary waking up with her bent over me. And I told my mother about the morning I'd had and the woman like telling me I was going to die and I hadn't had any coffee. And for once I was grateful for my mother being scary. My mother was not happy with any of this. So she had on like little Bon Marché heels and she clicked off to the back of the place. And I heard her chewing that woman out like, "You are not to go to my daughter's room first thing in the morning and tell her she's dying." For once, I was grateful for my mother being so scary. That's the same thing I would probably do. You're not to go to my daughter's room first thing in the morning and tell her she's dying.
Well, God, simple human decency to not have to hear that before your coffee, for God's sake.
But I don't have to hear that from a total stranger.
I don't have to hear it at all, really. I mean, how do they know?
That's all I wanted to tell her. You know, "Are you the right hand of God, lady?" And then, how do you know? I don't intend to drop dead. Life has never been sweeter. I intend to keep on living. I intend to outlive you, you little witch. I don't think she meant to be cruel, but I think there was something cruel about it.
It was callous and unsoulful. This wasn't very connected. I can't imagine.
I don't think I could do that. Tell anyone first thing in the morning, guess what? For X, Y, and Z reason, you're going to die.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that to anybody. I think maybe under any circumstance.
What a shitty job. Maybe I should talk to Merivik again. She came to visit me once. Merivik's an actual doctor.
Merivik actually introduced the woman I married and I. Because she knew we had the same birthday and she went to medical school with Lynn.
Mm-hmm. She thought that was a good sign.
She just thought we were kind of the same. And we'd like each other. And she liked the fact we had the same birthday. Aren't you a Pisces?
I don't know. May 6th?
May. What is that? March? April? May?
I think it's a Taurus.
Taurus. It's right after Aries.
Yeah, I'm very bullheaded. Mary came to visit me too. That was really sweet.
How did she know you were here?
My friend Elizabeth called her and told her.
Oh, Elizabeth Swaggart? Which Elizabeth?
Elizabeth Rudd.
Oh, okay. She was Swaggart though, right?
No, was she?
From Roosevelt and... Oh, Elizabeth Rudd, that's different.
Yes, her parents live like on 10th and they're doctors and nurses. And
oh, okay.
She's from a medical family and she and I went to read together. Still close. Elizabeth called a lot of people I knew in high school and I never had so many visitors in all my life.
Who else has been here?
My little sister. And that's been the most wonderful thing because she's been so angry at me for so long. I think just because I was a bossy older sister, mm-hmm. You know. And now she's all concerned. Now that I'm almost dying. And it was also the issue of I was my father's favorite. You know, I could speak French to him and discuss literature with him. I was very much like my father's son. And I guess while he was dying and I was spending every day with him, I think she was a little jealous. She really worshipped my father when he died. She went a little bonkers, if you ask me. He was the only person who was always there for her. He was the stable figure in her life. When he was working later in his career, he would be in the basement typing away, and she'd be sitting there on the floor, literally at his feet. Very close. I was surprised she did not go more to pieces when he died than she did.
Any visitors you'd like to see who I might know? About Matt Bergman, he went to Reed.
Yeah, I'd love to see Matt. I haven't seen him for like 20 years. Such a funny guy.
Yeah, he is, isn't he?
He was great at Reed. He really belonged there, you know. He's such a liberal. And
who else went to Reed? I'm trying to remember now.
Well, any kind of very smart, liberal, scientific type people.
I mean, from Roosevelt or from Eckstein or from that group.
I don't know. That was really, for me, 7 billion years ago. Matt was great at Reed. He was very friendly. He was very smart. He didn't have a lot of those high school prejudices. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah.
Once or twice he took me to his parents' store.
The Bergman luggage? Oh, yeah.
In general, it was a privilege to go to Reed. It was a place you could develop your mind. I cannot claim that I had that opportunity at high school in any respect. Except that maybe one or two classes with some really exceptional teachers. I can't believe I ended up being a teacher. There's some type of terrible karmic justice.
Is it me?
I had these great apartments in Chicago because I was making a lot of money. And one of them was in the top floor of an old Chicago bungalow, and it had St. Christopher medals. It was very old-fashioned, you know, and I set it up real nice, you know, because it had lots of cabinets with the pretty dishes and the CDs. And one day some kid came over to deliver a pizza, and he was looking around. He goes, "Are you a teacher?" I'm like, "How do you know?" He goes, "Well, my aunt is a teacher, and her apartment looks exactly like this." I found that kind of disturbing, you know, that I'd become so orderly or whatever. Divine, I was a teacher from the way I put up my CDs. I found that a little disturbing. I didn't really want to be identified by my profession. And I already felt so identified as a teacher, disturbing that people would look at me and go, "Oh, teacher." I can't remember if I tipped that pizza boy or not.
Well, you're teaching something that's halfway in between pure art and communications or something.
Rob, could you help me get on my feet so I could go to the bathroom?
Sure.
Oh my God, you're the only person in days who said yes. You guys reminded me that I'm not supposed to move around, or that so-and-so is coming to give me a shower.
How should I do it?
Well, let me start it off. I've been dreaming of being on my feet.
So you have a clip on you that probably alerts something if you get up.
I don't know if it alerts somebody. This is like, you press this button if you need help for, I don't know, whatever. You need your bottom wipe, do you need a cup of coffee, you press this button. So do you enjoy being married, or is it too much responsibility?
Well, we are separated now, so I'm not married anymore.
Oh.
But I did enjoy it, actually. I liked it.
I have not been legally married, but when I've been in a household with someone, I really loved it, particularly making a little household together. That was almost like building a little business. What style are you going to put out there, and which books, and... My first fiancé was French, and that was really a head trip. Because they are so French. The French are so French.
That's the thing about them.
Yeah, and it was spoiled rotten. I was eating shrimp in a Pernod sauce. And I didn't even have a button that didn't say Pierre Cardin on it. I was really spoiled rotten, and I don't think I appreciated it enough. Because money's never been that important to me. But all these many years later, I think he was the best man I ever met, and that is important to me. And I walked out on him, and that bothers me because I think it hurt him a lot. Recently I called and I apologized via phone at his job. I said that, you know, I said this horrible thing to him. He picked me up at the airport. I'd just come back from Mexico. And somewhere on the airport we pulled over and I said this horrible thing to him. I just really didn't know how else to bring it to a close. But I knew he was very unforgiving. He never forgives anyone. And I just said, I don't love you anymore. In the full confidence that he wouldn't be able to forgive that.
Was it true?
It's kind of, which part? That I didn't love him anymore? That he
yeah.
Both parts were fairly true. And it was really hard living with him because he was so French, you know. He was so stubborn, so opinionated. And he would do things like, I would be cooking something. And he would take it away from me, and he would start cooking it because he was a chef. And I would object because, you know, a woman wants to feel in charge of her own kitchen. And he would say, I know, Cherie, but I just don't want you to make a mistake. I want you to do it the right way. Stuff like that really drove us apart, you know. He used to say things like, oh my God, it drove me crazy. I did things the practical way, which implied that I saw things the impractical way. I don't know, it was hard. He was so French. That's what was so wonderful and so awful about him. He was so French.
I have a friend that for many years went out with a very French man, and that's what she used to say too.
That it was wonderful and it was awful.
Right, because he was so French.
On the other hand, I lived like a little princess. Everything I owned was Christian Dior, and we ate like pashas. Whenever we went out for dinner, the owner of the restaurant would come sit with us, and I loved all that shit. And, the big problem is that, he had no, it's not exaggeration to say he had no intellectual life, none.
Was it all about the senses for him, or without any?
I see things the practical way. What it was, unfortunately, he was left-handed. And at the time he was a little boy growing up in France, they still knocked around the left-handed kids and accused them of being the children of the devil. So he developed a kind of distaste for learning. You can't really blame him. And plus, some of these French country people have a genuine feeling that intellectuals are just people who don't want to work. They're too scared to get in the field. Does that make sense?
Sure.
They're just lazy. They obviously never wrote a term paper. So, yeah, he had that country people prejudice against intellectuals. So the work I did do, he didn't feel was very serious or important. So, yeah, we kind of fell apart over work issues. I somewhat regret it now because he was really such a good husband. He was an excellent provider. Everything was the best of everything, the best cars, the best clothes, obviously the best food. I'm sure he would have become less stubborn over time. And he was the most romantic person ever. He used to call me... Do you speak French?
No.
He used to call me mon amour, bien aimé. That means my love, well loved. Hmm. And he really was that insanely romantic. He took me to France and... I met his family, and that was fascinating because the way they lived in this little farmhouse about the size of this area that had been in the mother's family a long time. And if the father didn't marry her, he wouldn't have had any land. Mm-hmm. Not having any land is like not having any dick for them. You know, it's just like a man without land is just a joke. Mm-hmm. And so they had this little farmhouse, and the father had retired. He started a little vegetable garden for the house. And the first year, he didn't know how to make anything in a small quantity. The first year he had made 2 tons of carrots. It got to be a joke in the village. At first he went down and sold them. Later he started to give them away. It got to the point he couldn't even give them away. You know, his two tons of carrots. The Femmivillard, that was their last name. They were pretty good to me. That was an experience going to France. Everything so the same and so different, and my God, how we ate. I also went to a little makeup shop where they... It's a little different than here because they have all the makeups there. So maybe your makeup job is $50. Mm-hmm. But they use all different products, and they did a very sophisticated job. I just really don't like makeup that much. I think they charged me $60, and they did this beautiful green eyeshadow. They really did do a good job. Mm-hmm. They did the hair, too. It's these little cliniques where you go in and you get your hair done, your makeup done. And
sounds fun. You could emerge a slightly different person.
I think he had a really good time because when he was a young man and he lived in Paris, he didn't really have much money. Paris is not fun to live in with a lot of money. So now he'd come back a big success with plenty of money. And I think he bought a lot of things that he couldn't afford to buy when he was a young man. And one thing he was fascinated with is coupe. Do you know what a French coupe is?
I should, but it's not coming to mind immediately.
It's really a banana split.
Oh.
You know. But loaded up with the richest, most decadent ice cream.
Uh-huh.
And every night he wanted to have one of those coupes. Got to the point where I start to feel like really heavy. You know, I don't have the desire to eat a banana split every night. So we went out for these coupes, but I realized for him, it was part of expressing his success.
Uh-huh.
You know, because he was very successful in America. Now he can afford to eat a coupe every night. You know, they were incredibly good. He wanted to eat one every single night. He never tired of them. I didn't want to deny him his expression of his wealth and his success.
It's like denying a little kid, you know, ice cream when they have, when they enjoy it. It's kind of a divine thing.
Ice cream is a sort of divinity. I think there's some types of ice cream that are actually called divinity. And he showed me many things in Paris. My favorite was, he showed me this creepy cafe with the most expensive, outrageous pastries, actually dusted in gold.
Wow.
And that's where the older ladies go in the afternoon to get themselves a pastry and a little boy.
Mm-hmm.
Or a medium-sized boy, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And they look kind of like big spiders.
Ooh.
Sitting with their expensive pastry and expensive coffee, about to pick up what they want.
Mm.
These pastries are very expensive. You wouldn't just breeze into the shop. They're like 20 to 50 bucks a pop. So, you know, it's like going to a very expensive bar to pick up a boy.
Uh-huh.
The expense of the place is some sort of guarantee that you won't get anyone or anything too creepy. And the little gigolos were kind of fascinating. They're all kind of pretty and skinny and... And I thought, wow, what a way to make a living, wow. I don't know where they service this woman later. Do they take them to their home? To the boy's home? To the woman's home? To the alley? Like,
it's 50 bucks for a pastry, probably not the alley. Because it'll be the price on top of that for the boy.
How much cash do you think she gives him? $100?
I don't know.
Probably at least 50 now.
Oh, yeah.
So the whole thing's around $100. I never paid for sex. Seems like that would be super sad. It's like you admit, like, I smell so bad, I'm so ugly. I'm so uncharming. I know so few sex acts, I can't get anyone to do this with me for free.
Yeah. That's probably how men feel a lot of the time. That's why they turn to that.
That's why they pay?
Yeah.
Just to have no worries.
Flying back to San Francisco tomorrow.
Oh, I haven't been there for ages.
Tomorrow night. Still beautiful.
How much is the flight?
It's really cheap now. It's amazing how cheap it is to fly back and forth. It's like
$49
bucks each way.
You going out of SeaTac?
Yeah.
Maybe I'll tag along just for an adventure, if you don't mind.
Need the last minute ticket. I just love flying. I'm staring out the window and everything. It's just like being in a dream.
Tomorrow night you're going back to San Fran?
Mm-hmm.
Is it still a wonderful place?
Oh yeah.
It's not all yuppified to hell?
Yeah, it's a little bit yuppified, but it's still great there.
Where do you go eat in San Francisco?
I don't go out to eat that much. I go to the little corner kind of delis, and I like that kind of New York experience you have where you're always at the local little places where everybody knows you or seen you around.
Do you eat white food? Do you eat Asian food there?
Oh, I eat everything.
Everything is good?
Yeah.
Remember there used to be a lot of great stationery stores with little funny hideaway stores in San Francisco.
Well, you know, there's plenty of little nooks and crannies to explore. Real estate's so expensive there, like New York, you do, or Paris, you do end up with little teeny stores with interesting things in them.
So how much is a co-op there? Like $500,000 now?
I don't know about the co-ops, but it's just too expensive to buy a place, practically. It's nuts. I think it's more expensive than New York, even. Or Manhattan.
Didn't you used to have a partner in the bike shop?
Chris Rusden.
How is Chris?
He lives in Australia now. I haven't talked to him in many years.
That really seems like that's where he'd end up, yeah. What about his crazy sister?
Ashley? She married and I'm not sure where she... I haven't talked to her in just as long or longer. I don't know where she actually ended up. I should call his dad up and get the download. Chris is doing really well, though. He's got a kid and got all the toys, and he works for Hertz. He's like a manager.
He had that kind of personality.
Mm-hmm. John Moses, remember him? He was a friend of Chris's. They grew up together.
He was a total god, wasn't he?
He used to drive the Jeeps around with me and dirt bike riding and stuff. He wasn't that tall. He lived in Sandpoint Country Club. Other characters. He goes back and forth between Norway and Whidbey Island.
He does some of a business thing in Norway.
He's a professor. He had some great adventures. He traveled around the world. He's in a Viking boat and married a Greenlandic Eskimo, and they were together for many years and broke up. He went to school in Moscow when you couldn't even get in and learned Russian.
Do you know my friend? He's a very talented artist, Paul. I can't think of his last name. Paul. He speaks Russian. He's very talented. Artist. Just can't think of his last name. What would we do without our names to identify us?
Maybe try to come up with some other... sensual nomenclature to distinguish ourselves from others.
Like, hello, I'm Nicole, very soft breasts.
Really? Pleased to meet you.
I'm Senior Fred, extremely long penis.
I was thinking more like a combination of, you know, the synesthesia smell and visual and something that is more subtle that we elicit, the crazy magnetic field that we're all too deaf and dumb to perceive. Because we have these names, these clunky things that we use, and we don't need anything that's more sophisticated.
The names are, or...
The names, I think, are a bit clunky, but they're charming.
So a girl would have a name like Honeysuckle Essence, Expensive Plaid French Jumper.
Ooh, I like that.
I like Honeysuckle. Wait to go home. Our real home is like 2 blocks away from the nursing home.
Really?
Yeah.
That'd be nice.
Can't wait to go.
They give me a date? What? You have to sneak out or?
Sneak out and or get discharged.
Hmm.
Very near MLK. That was his house. It's a cute little house. It's really nice to live in a house instead of an apartment.
Yeah.
had a garden where we could go out and have a cigarette, you know. And that's where I want to go back. We had a lot of happiness in my house.
Seems like you should be able to.
Go back. I don't like looking up and looking around the house for my husband. Plus it just feels weird and wrong. It's much better being like, oh, he's sleeping in his bedroom, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And you whiz by the hall, you hear him breathing, and that's as much checking as you need to do.
Thank you. You didn't sign, though.
Okay. So that house is like 3-4 blocks that way. On, Cross Street Jackson.
Yeah.
And MLK. And then the other place I got us, just because I thought our place was way too run down, is, I don't know, just one block north. I can walk there. It's 2 blocks away.
Distance trains, taxis, bicycling's fun.
Hot.
Well, I have to go meet someone for dinner.
Okay. Brock, if you could live in any city in the world, what would it be?
Well, I do live in a city. But the city I want to go live in is Cape Town, South Africa.
Oh, have you been there?
Yeah.
What's special about Cape Town?
Cape Town's beautiful.
Physical beauty?
Very, very beautiful. And diverse. And quirky. And kind of a little lost in time.
See strange animals here and there.
Strange plants. All the energy from the whole continent sweeps down to that point.
Sounds really interesting. If you like the eccentric and the odd, which I do, it sounds kind of intriguing. I love some of these nature shows. First of all, the film is so beautifully. Like the ones where these three of these creatures left on this island, do you know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
One of the trippiest things that, well, as a filmmaker, you're like, how did they do that? First of all, they have to enormous patience to sit there and wait all day for those two birds to show up. One of my favorite ones I ever saw, I thought it was like a real life lesson, was about these birds. They nest in these caves, but their natural enemies are these snakes that have terrific stomach muscles that lean off the tops of these caves, and then they go into these little...
Wow.
They try and eat a bird.
Uh-huh.
You know, and they know they're in there. And it was this fascinating character detail of these parents. They had 3 birds. And then the thing is, that's when the work begins, because these little things are so hungry. that the two parents on their own can never get these babies fed. The entire family, uncles, aunts, younger brothers and sisters, they'll have to whiz around all day to try to get a worm or whatever, come back to the cave, and feed the babies. And one of these birds was kind of a bully. He started to be like, wah! Like, make a lot of noise and, like, waddle up to the front of the cage to make sure he got fed. So that worked. He got fed first, and he got bigger and bigger. And one day, he kicked one of his brothers out of the cave. You know, in order that there should be more food for him. And there was something kind of hateful about it, you know, if you're basically well brought up. Make sure you share your sandwich with your sister kind of thing. So, this one bird keeps getting bigger and bigger and eating more and more, and his younger brother starts wasting away. It's very distasteful. And as his younger brother gets smaller and smaller, one day the bigger brother just kicks him out the front window, or front door, whatever it is. As this is going on, as the middle brother keeps getting more aggressive, one day his basic technique is to waddle close to the front door, so the parents come back with all the food he gets first. He does this one day, and there's this strange divine justice. These snakes have figured out how to stick their head inside the hole. As he waddles to the front of